Thanks for joining us. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Presidential candidates hold a final debate before the Iowa caucuses without the man whom a Fox News moderator called the elephant not in the room, Donald Trump. The FBI releases a video of a shooting death of an Oregon protester, and President Obama is expected today to adopt new rules aimed at preventing companies from paying women less for doing the same work as men. Joining me for today's domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup of a very busy week, Jeff Mason with Reuters, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, and Chris Freites of CNN. Welcome, everyone.
Great to be here.
And if you, the listener, would like to join our conversation, you can always call us at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet to @drshow. I also want to remind people that the first hour of the Friday News Roundup is live streaming, so you can watch that video screen on drshow.org. All right, so let's start with what feels like it has become the biggest show on earth, or was it, without the main attraction? I'm referring, of course, to the GOP debate last night. Without Trump, smart move on his part or not? Jeff.
You know, he managed to keep himself in the lead of the story all day long yesterday by not going to the debate. Whether or not it was a smart move in terms of his ability to get voters out in Iowa or New Hampshire a week or so later is something that we won't know until the actual caucus happens and the primary happens. But he absolutely kept attention on himself by not being center stage last night. And for that, I'm sure he'll view that as a big success.
And stole some ratings, right, from Fox News?
He stole some ratings. I don't think he's going to compete with the debate. I mean, those numbers have not been released yet, and it looks like the Fox debate is on track to attract less viewers than its first one, which was 25 million. It was huge. It was the biggest in cable news, so they were never going to hit that again. We've seen, you know, people, less and less people watch them. But he will certainly try to take credit, I think, by saying, oh, they got less ratings because I was not there. But I think the other thing politically that was interesting to watch that we've talked a lot, was it good or bad for Trump? But the other thing he did is he forced the bullseye onto Ted Cruz's back. And Ted Cruz, I'm sure, was not happy with the Des Moines Register front page today, which said that he had a rough
Cruz.
Night, you know, rough mm-hmm. Cruz's rough night. That was not the headline he was looking for coming out of
for sure.
this debate. And of course, Cruz being the top rival to Donald Trump, he, you know, Trump, by stepping out of the ring of fire, you know, put Ted into it. I think that was a pretty smart move as well, as those two compete and are very ferociously trying to win Iowa. Cruz, of course, says that if Trump takes Iowa, it could be a runaway train and he will run off with the nomination. And he is setting himself up as the firewall to stop a Donald Trump Republican presidential nominee.
You know, as you say, he's trying to take credit for a drop in ratings. They might have dropped anyway for the debate. But Cheryl, give us a very quick reminder of why it is that he boycotted the debate.
So he boycotted the debate because he is in a long-running standoff with Megyn Kelly, the Fox News anchor, who asked him some tough questions about his treatment of women in the first Fox News debate. He came back and said he didn't like her questions and she had blood pouring out of her eyes, her ears, her wherever. It was widely interpreted as a remark referring to menstruation. They've been battling ever since. Donald Trump said he wasn't going to participate in this debate unless Megyn Kelly was not a moderator. Fox put its foot down, said, "We're sorry, you don't get to pick your moderators." Not only that, issued a tweet saying, what is Donald Trump going to do when, you know, Putin or other world leaders or the Ayatollah, you know, challenge him? Is he going to run scared and not debate? And so it was a big showdown. I also think, frankly, it was a moment of theater and a masterstroke on Donald Trump's part. One thing that he did that was brilliant was he commanded a lot of cameras. If you were clicking back and forth, as I was last night, you could watch Fox, the debate, which was frankly kind of a snooze, or you could flip to CNN and you could see Donald Trump announcing that his show was kind of like the Academy Awards. Not only that, he got the two previous Iowa winners, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, up on stage with him because they were in the undercard debate. They came over to try to get a little moment in the spotlight, and he very smartly called them up on stage, and you saw Rick Santorum sort of awkwardly say, I don't really want to be here in front of this Trump sign. So all in all, it was, I think, an example of Trump's kind of master showmanship.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant mastery of the moment. As you say, the undercard debate, meaning they were so low polling that they couldn't be in the main debate.
Exactly.
So this was a way to, for them to get some primetime attention without going so far as to endorse Trump.
Exactly.
But Jeff, let's go a little bit deeper on this question about without Trump, Ted Cruz, the Texas senator who had been leading polls in Iowa, has gotten himself center stage, but did he help himself? We heard about the Des Moines Register front page story saying he didn't.
Yeah, which was, no, as Chris said, definitely not the headline he was looking for this morning. He did come under a lot of fire last night. He was center stage. He was pressed a lot on his shifting views on immigration. He gave back fire, but the fire, the incoming that he took seemed to be greater than the other way around. You know, on one hand, it's probably good for, you know, no attention or no bad attention or good attention. It's all good attention when you want to get eyeballs on your website or eyeballs on your candidacy. But for sure, not having somebody else for some of that to go to, and not having the chance to directly attack Donald Trump and make it sort of a two-man show, which is what Cruz would have liked to have had, was not what he was looking for.
Because Cruz, of course, is himself a prize-winning college debater, has really mastered the sort of debate format, so he wanted to have a chance to go mano a mano with his big rival,
and
Trump.
And he's been asking for a one-on-one with Trump since Trump isn't come, since Trump did not come last night.
Right, which Trump has so far not agreed to.
Right.
So, Chris, how did the other candidates who were not talking about, how did they do without Trump on the big stage?
Well, I think what was interesting was to watch Marco Rubio, who had a pretty standout night. He had always performed well in previous debates, but to see him last night really kind of go after Ted Cruz, because remember, you know, they're going to be, the Rubio campaign is kind of shooting for a strong third place showing. They know that they're not going to win, but the way that the delegates are proportioned, you know, nobody's going to come out of there with a majority of the delegates, so they think if they can come in with a strong third, that puts them in a good place to go on to New Hampshire. And it was interesting to watch Rubio because he kind of did, you know, you got to see him take on Cruz a little bit more and get into that thing that those of us who've covered him has kind of seen him get. He gets kind of yelly, you know, when he's making a point. He gets more and more kind of like pumped up about it till it's like, it's about America, right? And so, you know, watching that and then, you know, trying the back and forth on immigration in particular, him attacking Ted Cruz, saying you've changed your position. Ted Cruz saying, well, no, it's Rubio who's the guy who's really for amnesty. And to watch that battle played out, I think helped guys like Marco Rubio. And also, I think when you saw Jeb Bush, I think that was Jeb Bush's strongest debate. Now, a lot of us have stopped talking about him because he's polling so badly, even in a place like New Hampshire, where he really has to, you know, break out and become the mainstream, you know, choice. And that's the lane that Marco Rubio is, you know, in right now, and he needs to take out Rubio. But I thought that Bush was stronger than he'd ever been. He seemed on point, energized. He didn't seem that low energy candidate the way Donald Trump always talked about him. So I thought, you know, he also had a good night. So I thought it was an ability for some of these other guys to get more minutes. And I think you saw that, you know, you had Cruz and Rubio had more minutes, and then even Bush had more minutes than he had without Trump in the room.
You know what also struck me? Rand Paul and John Kasich. Rand Paul was forced off the stage in the last debate. Rand Paul, though he's polling very low numbers, had a very good night to articulate and have the time to articulate his libertarian point of view. The other thing that jumped out at me was the way the Fox moderators used video clips of Rubio and Cruz's past statements on immigration reform to show how their positions had changed. And it was tough for both of them to have to look at those clips and then defend the positions they had taken previously.
I say they weren't flip-floppers.
It was really nice.
I thought it was, too. And I was surprised because oftentimes campaigns will negotiate that kind of thing out of a debate. And they'll say, you know, you can't play these clips. And so obviously that was not negotiated.
So did the debate change any minds?
I don't know. I don't know that it changed the state of play. I defer to my gentleman colleagues. What do you think?
I mean, I agree with you, Cheryl. I don't know that we know that. But the question was, this was the last chance for Iowa voters to see the whole field in a debate setting. And there are people who are still making up their minds. And we know that people in Iowa you'll wait till the last minute to hear things. And then the caucuses are very different than a primary. You don't go into a voting booth by yourself and cast your vote in private. You caucus. You meet with your friends. There's peer pressure involved. There's some horse trading that goes on. That's a different experience. And this will be one of the last times they see all the candidates together. And that's the enduring image that they're taking.
And that's also the potential. I mean, and I'm going to be the last person to say this is going to hurt Trump, because every time anyone has said it's going to hurt Trump, it doesn't. But it might, insofar as that last image that those voters have, or caucus goers have, going into their heads, does not have him on the stage.
And the words of Cruz saying, "I'm at least we," meaning the candidates up on the stage, "had the respect for Iowa voters to show up here."
And that's something they could remember, and that's something that they could punish Trump for when they go into those caucus debates.
Well, you guys make a really important reminder point to listeners about how the caucus process is different from a primary. You don't just go into a booth and pull a lever. You actually have to go into a room and negotiate with your neighbors, and sometimes in a small precinct, one family could swing the vote. We actually did an entire hour yesterday on voter turnout in the early states and why it matters. So listeners can go to our webpage at drshow.org if they want to hear about that. I want to just read an email from Peggy, who says, "The best thing I've read about the debate is by Glenn Thrush in Politico. It was the worst possible time on the eve of the deadlocked Iowa caucuses for Cruz to stumble, and Trump dug that pothole." She says that sums up the entire debate for me. So we're going to take a short break now. I look forward to hearing other questions and comments from you. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. This hour for the Domestic News Roundup, I'm joined by Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, national correspondent at The New York Times, Chris Freitz, an investigative correspondent with CNN. And I want to remind you that you can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. You can also join us by telephone 1-800-433-8850, send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or send us a Facebook message or a tweet. So, Jeff, I want to start with you and ask about how, you know, okay, we talked about this final debate in Iowa, and the candidates are making this sprint. We're talking about voting in Iowa on Monday, and then we're going to have New Hampshire just a week past that. Why is voter turnout so important in this race, and for whom does it matter most?
Turnout shows whether or not the polls are right. So if you can have great polling numbers, you can have momentum for candidates like Donald Trump, candidates like Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. But if those voters, or in this case, caucus goers, don't show up and raise their hands, then you're not going to win. And so it is, you ask, which candidates does it matter for the most? It matters the most for those two. It matters the most for Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side because he's had a lot of momentum. He's been rising against Clinton. But if those folks just say, "Hey, I really like this guy, I like his liberal policies, I like his progressive attitude," but don't show up on Monday night, then that could be the end of a lot of the momentum that he's had. And the same for Trump.
And the polls that we've seen show that actually Hillary Clinton has the advantage over Bernie Sanders among definite caucus goers. And I think the same is true for Cruz's advantage over Trump in terms of people who say they will definitely be voting. Is that right, Cheryl?
Right. And so and that's one reason why it's so important, especially for Sanders, for voters to come out. Because we know that Sanders is really quite far ahead in New Hampshire. He's far ahead of Hillary Clinton. So he needs a good win in Iowa, because once this debate or this race swings past New Hampshire and Iowa to South Carolina, that's where Hillary Clinton is going to be very strong. Bernie Sanders has a weakness with African American voters. And if Hillary Clinton does lose both Iowa and New Hampshire, she's going to come back very strong in the South there. So I think, you know, Bernie's going to need to really turn people out and try to pull an Obama of 2008 in Iowa.
And it's interesting because he was asked this question just this week. Do you think you can do what Barack Obama did in 2008? And he said, I don't think so. He kind of copped to it. I mean, President Obama put together what was a pretty unprecedented coalition of young voters, non-traditional voters, first-time voters, and he really fired them up and then had an operation to get them to the polls. And they started that operation very, very early in the campaign. And what Bernie Sanders didn't do was put that kind of get-out-the-vote operation on the ground. These are staffers. These are people who get caucus goers into vans and buses and take them to the caucusing locations. And he has built that, but he was at a disadvantage always to Hillary Clinton, who started on the ground immediately with that. Because remember, and Sanders, you know, will tell you this over and over again, you know, he started at the polls in Iowa at 3%. Mm-hmm. I mean, he, you know, he kind of built a movement around his candidacy in the same way that Obama did, but was a little later to the game on the organization. And we saw the same thing for Trump. Ted Cruz has a whole dormitory in Iowa of people who have come in from Texas and other places across the country to help get those voters to the caucuses in Iowa. Donald Trump, while he got started in the fall building that, there's a big question about whether they can bring those voters out.
Worth noting as well that Hillary Clinton inherited or hired a lot of people from the former Obama campaign.
And so they have a lot of experience with getting out the vote, getting people to polls.
Exactly.
That's right, getting the ground game. But, of course, on the Republican side right now, I think a lot of these candidates, particularly the ones who aren't in first and second place in Iowa, meaning anyone whose name is not Trump or Cruz, is looking beyond Iowa.
For sure.
And they're trying to look for strong finishes in New Hampshire and beyond.
Yeah, you've got particularly people like Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, if he can make it, wanting to have a strong finish in New Hampshire. Some people saying, you know, if they don't finish strongly both in Iowa and New Hampshire, that they'll start seeing people drop out of the race. And, you know, a Jeb Bush who has so much money, despite the fact that he spent quite a bit of it, probably has the cash to stay in. But those types of questions will start being asked after these races, and that will be hurtful
to
the ones
is where the
who are not polling well.
This is where the winnowing is going to come. First of all, John Kasich, for instance, the Ohio governor, has really poured everything he has into New Hampshire. So that primary is do or die for him. Rand Paul is running for Senate back home in Kentucky, and he's just gotten a competitor in the race. Lexington Mayor Jim Gray has just jumped in the race. Rand Paul has engineered a March 5th Kentucky caucus, a Republican caucus in Kentucky for president, so that he could run for both president and the Senate at the same time. He's going to have to, you know, turn his attention.
A lot of competing demands.
Yeah.
All right, Chris, I want to talk about President Obama's role in this race and where he is putting his weight. There was an interview he did this week with Politico's Glenn Thrush, who was mentioned earlier. He said that Hillary Clinton was battle-tested and ready to go, essentially, ready to start on day one because of her experience under him, something that he could not say of Bernie Sanders. Is the president finally embracing Hillary Clinton full on? Was this a sort of unspoken endorsement?
I think that this is a fascinating question because both the president and some of the people around him will say that was not an endorsement. But so many of the loyalists around Obama will tell you on background that, of course, he sees Hillary Clinton as his natural successor. It was his Secretary of State. They grew a strong relationship. And you see that on the trail with Hillary Clinton. I mean, she is all but hugging the president. And you might ask, why would she do that when this president has such unfavorable ratings across the country? More people dislike what he's doing than like it. But within the Democratic base, Obama is still very, very popular. So that was a big deal that he said that she was battle tested, ready to go, and said that he didn't see a lot of similarities between his 2008 movement and Bernie Sanders. He said they were different. And now, of course, Sanders met with the president earlier this week, went to the White House, and came out and said, I don't think the president put his finger on a scale. I think he's been very even handed, and I don't get that sense at all. But it was also interesting to watch the optics of that. Bernie Sanders outside the White House at the mics doing a press availability to talk about his meeting with President Obama to signal to all those primary voters, hey, I'm cool with the president, too. He's seeing me. I'm getting FaceTime. It's not just Hillary who is a buddy-buddy. I'm cool, too. What you didn't see was Hillary Clinton come to any microphones on December 7th when she had lunch with the president, because she doesn't need to.
She gets plenty of FaceTime with the president, and they have these regular lunches. Mm-hmm. And so that was not her only lunch with the president or her only chance to get him on the phone. And as you say, interesting that Bernie Sanders made a point of saying the president has not endorsed anyone, and I commend the president for having, you know, maintained neutrality.
Also interesting from the White House perspective, mm-hmm. the White House, when Hillary Clinton came over for lunch, did not announce it until afterwards. Mm-hmm. This one they announced in advance that it was happening. So
and made the point to say that it was scheduled before Thrush's article came out in Politico that really kind of got this conversation going all week.
But still a little sensitive to the idea that the president might be putting his thumb
on
the scale.
But let's not forget that a sitting president is never going to pick sides in advance of a party having a nominee. But the president has been sending signals. A couple weeks ago, he said he wouldn't support any candidate who didn't agree with him on gun control.
Well, certainly President Clinton chose Gore outright.
Well, that's true, his vice president.
Yes.
But in this case, this didn't
seem like Hillary jumped on that.
Right.
To suggest, we have the president's backing. We're with the president.
And ran
an issue ad saying we're with the president and forcing Sanders to reconsider his position.
And now he's co-sponsoring the bill that reverse the bill he previously voted for.
The most important thing to President Obama in this election is that somebody wins who can keep his legacy. Mm-hmm. And he believes that to be Hillary Clinton. He's not going to say that before the primary is over. Surely if Bernie Sanders were to win, he will support him. But he and his advisors believe Hillary Clinton is the most likely person to keep his legacy going.
Jeff, give us a very quick review of the clashing that we saw between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in this town hall earlier this week. We've seen more and more of them clashing rather than being kind of palsy as they were on the debate stages earlier on, as their poll numbers have gotten so much closer.
Right, and that's the reason, because their poll numbers have gotten so much closer. Both candidates are more willing to go on the attack against the other one. You had Sanders saying he likes Hillary Clinton, but experience isn't everything, and saying that this is somebody who will be your friend only when it matters. And he listed things like Wall Street reform. He listed things like on guns, on the Keystone Pipeline, on free trade. He also really highlighted her vote for the Iraq mm-hmm. War, which is still a sensitive topic among the liberal base, and that's something that he's sort of using to really go against her on a weakness there. Hillary Clinton, on the other side, really talking a lot about her experience and saying, you know, Sanders' ideas were fantastic, or his ad, one of the ads that they showed was fantastic, but she was the one who could actually lead and was prepared to lead.
Cheryl, quickly, the New York Times, your paper, reported of a possible presidential run by former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. If it's true, what are the implications?
Well, I think it's very interesting if it's true. I think Michael Bloomberg is figuring that in perhaps a Trump Sanders or even a Trump Clinton year, you know, he can sort of appeal to the middle. I think if it were Trump Clinton or any Republican Clinton, I think Bloomberg pulls away from Clinton. He goes for people who are experiencing Clinton fatigue. He's someone who has been very strong on gun control. He's an independent now, was a Republican, very strong on gun control, very strong on immigration reform. So he touches those kind of liberal touchstones. But he also is a businessman, an experienced businessman. So if on the Republican side you have a Trump nominee, he's got the business base. He's certainly no Democratic.
Billionaire.
No, right. in case you need another billionaire. Not, and speaking of billionaire, he said he's willing to put $1 billion of his own money into financing his own campaign. So this is not, you know, this is a serious politician with money behind him.
So at the end of the day, is it worse for the Democrats or worse for the Republicans if Michael Bloomberg enters the race?
I think it's,
what do you think, Chris?
I think it's probably worse for the Republicans. I think it siphons off, you know, some of that Trump vote, particularly if it's billionaire versus billionaire.
I think it depends on who the Republican is, though.
Right. If it's Trump. If it's Trump, I think it would hurt Trump in the same way that Republicans were so worried that Trump would strike out as an independent candidate if he did not win that nomination. So I think that is the worry.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. You can also watch the live video stream of our conversation right now on drshow.org. So I want to move on to the question about Obama attending this Democratic congressional retreat in Baltimore yesterday. What was his message, Jeff?
His message was kind of a rallying cry for Democrats. He did what has been sort of a continuous thing for him in recent months, a bit of a victory lap, talking about how the economy is much better, unemployment at 5%, the health care law that this is his signature achievement on the domestic policy stage, and saying that that Democrats are going to win in November. So really sort of giving a pep talk to the Dems and giving, you know, pouring cold water on Republicans for their criticism about his policies on Islamic State and other foreign policy promises that he thinks are unrealistic.
I think we ought to look at the numbers, though. Democrats have had a tough ride under the Obama presidency. When President Obama addressed Democrats at this similar retreat in 2009, there were 259 of them in the House. Today, there are 188. All across the country, it's not just Congress. Democrats now occupy 10 fewer governorships than they did when he took office. The GOP, the Republicans, have 32 of the nation's governorships. Democratic losses in state legislatures during Mr. Obama's tenure have been practically unprecedented, the worst, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, in 115 years. So, you know, I think this is, Democrats, frankly, have reason to feel dispirited.
And also the Democrat-in-chief himself is going to have a hard time getting, you know, it's his final year in the White House. He wants certain legislation through. Can he even accomplish that? Can Congress get that done in an election year?
No. And they're not going to. And so that's why it was more pep rally than, hey, team, let's go do it. And remember, Democrats have never been really hot on President Obama. He has always held that branch of government at arm's length, and that has always bothered Democrats.
You mean congressional Democrats?
Congressional Democrats in particular. I've talked to, you know, members, senators, members, chiefs of staff who say, you know, the president doesn't regularly reach out. You know, Democratic senators who haven't heard from the president in 2 years.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the kinds of things that they saw him in the Senate for a couple years. Then he left, and he never was a consensus builder.
That's why Joe Biden has been so important. One reason Joe Biden has been a very important vice president for President Obama, because Joe Biden had, you know, 3 decades worth of experience in the Hill, very deep relationships on both sides of the aisle. And so we've seen whenever President Obama has needed something done on the Hill, because his own relationships are thin up there, he would send Biden.
Biden kept the lines open to the Senate,
he really,
and the
did.
House.
Right,
and
speaking of Joe Biden, he made kind of a cool quote last night by saying that the Republican race was a gift from the Lord for Democrats in 2016 and the possibility of regaining control of the Senate and the House.
But to Cheryl's point earlier, I think Democrats have a very thin bench. After Hillary Clinton, I mean, just look at this presidential. You didn't have anybody except Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley get in. There weren't other folks like Amy Klobuchar, you know, a senator from Minnesota, other kinds of people even testing the waters here. And when you look at the bench all the way down to the state legislature, Democrats control, you know, fewer than they have since
the
Civil War.
And that's a problem going forward.
Going forward, I think. And that's part of Obama's legacy, is that he did not build a bench, and that everybody looked upwards and said, it's great, we have President Obama, okay, we lost the House, but we're still controlling things nationally. across the country, Democrats have a lot of rebuilding to do, and that's going to be a big job for the next president if they're a Democrat.
Of course, what the president has managed to do is use his last year or so in office with a lot of executive orders, trying to take executive action if Congress couldn't. And one of the things he did this week had to do with juvenile justice, his efforts to reform juvenile justice, the criminal justice system in general. In the minute we have before we go to our break, Jeff, just quickly remind us what happened this week.
Sure.
The president and the Supreme Court, in
fact. The president and the Supreme Court took different actions to help juveniles who are sentenced to life. In the case of the Supreme Court, the court ruled that people who are convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment, but who were under 18 when that happened,
without parole,
exactly, would have an opportunity or should have an opportunity to receive parole. And on the other side of Washington, the White House, President Obama issued an executive order banning the use of solitary confinement for juveniles. So two actions that could really help convicted criminals who were convicted at a young age in their time in prison.
A couple thousand inmates who will be affected by the Supreme Court decision. And of course, it'll affect federal prisons in terms of the juveniles with Obama's decision on solitary confinement. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we'll go to your calls and your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Joining me this hour to talk about the top headlines in domestic news this week, Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, national correspondent at the New York Times, and Chris Freitz, investigative correspondent with CNN. You can see all three of them on our live video stream at drshow.org. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850, send us an email, a tweet, or a message on Facebook. Before the break, we were talking about an executive action by the president to ban, solitary confinement for juveniles. There's another executive action that it seems he's going to be taking today, Cheryl, that your newspaper has written about, and that is to try to mend this persistent wage gap between men and women, which is currently 77 cents that the average woman earns in America for doing the same work as a man, which I was struck has only gone up by half a cent a year over the last half century. Yeah. What is the president going to do about it?
Well, so this is actually coming out of the Department of Labor, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it's going to be a new rule requiring companies that have 100 employees or more to report to the federal government what they pay by race, gender, and ethnicity. So in essence, it is an executive action by the administration requiring companies to give over that information so that this can be tracked. And what strikes me is that this really harks back to President Obama's very first days in office. The first bill he signed as president was the Lilly Ledbetter Act, requiring equal pay for equal work, growing out of a lawsuit filed by a woman of the same name, Lilly Ledbetter. And I think it's a theme that we're seeing actually throughout the Obama administration, especially at the end of the president's presidency, to push for equality, not only for women, but also, as Jeff talked about, in the criminal justice system for African Americans. And it will probably provoke a backlash because Republicans, as we've said, are up in arms over the way this administration has used its executive authority.
Well, the idea is that the president is going to force companies with 100 employees or more to list their salary information on a form that specifies the sex, the age, the race, and the job groups of its employees. I want to ask you, Chris, about another major thing going on this week, which is this Oregon standoff that at first looked like it was going to be coming to a close between the FBI and protesters. And then what happened?
Well, and then we saw 11 militants altogether of the folks who were holding that wildlife refuge in Oregon. They were arrested. One was killed in a standoff with the FBI and police. And we think there's still a small group, three or four, who are still remaining there. They say that they want to leave, but they don't want to be arrested. Negotiators with the government saying, well, we can't guarantee that if there were laws that have been broken. And Armin Bundy, the kind of leader of this group, he has been arrested and called on this group to leave peacefully. And if you remember, he took up this cause. There was a land dispute with him and his father a few years ago over cattle rights. He's kind of taken up this mantle of, you know, the federal government controlling federal lands, and that this idea that it should be given back to the people. The people in the wildlife refuge were holding on to it, saying that it should go from the federal government to the local government, and it should not be the federal land. Now, the case of the matter is it is federal land, and they were trespassing on federal land, and now we are seeing that play out in the courts. Mundy now taking a different tack, saying, look, end the siege of the refuge. We're going to take this to the courts, and we will find out through discovery what the federal government knows, and that's another way to go. So we're seeing kind of, you know, one person was killed, but by and large, a peaceful end to what was a fairly long siege.
Although there are a couple of guys still holed up, and negotiators have been going back and forth trying to get them out, also employing a woman who is just sort of a member of the public who supports the protesters going in and out. Jeff, tell us about the video that the FBI has now released showing the shooting of the one protester who did die.
Right. I think they're trying to show with that video that they did not act in a way that was irresponsible, that they tried very much to get him to surrender, and the fact that he didn't surrender and then apparently reached for his pocket is the reason that he was shot. And that's their reasoning for releasing that video, is to show that, look, we wanted this to end peacefully too, and it couldn't, or it didn't, for this reason.
Yeah, the FBI said yesterday that he had a 9mm gun in his pocket that he was reaching for, and you know, this is a very tense situation.
And the video shows him reaching.
And let's not forget the history here of other sieges like Waco and Ruby Ridge. The government really wanted to avoid, a lot of death and mayhem. But this has gone on for a long time. Oregon's governor has pleaded with the federal government for some kind of resolution. Indian tribes in the area also, an Indian tribe in Oregon views this land as sacred land and was growing increasingly disturbed that ancient remains and artifacts could be dug up. So there was also a feeling in the community out there that this needed to come to some kind of an end.
And there was some criticism that the federal government did leave it go on
too long.
And while trying to make sure that they're negotiating something peaceful and there wouldn't be any kind of massacre at the end of it, the townspeople closest to that refuge were alarmed that armed men were coming in and out, that they were holding, you know, these kind of town meetings while they were armed at local high schools. So there was a lot of concern about how this was handled and if it was handled as quickly as maybe it should have been.
And Cheryl mentioned Waco and Ruby Ridge, and for listeners who may not remember those, the similarity, of course, is that those were protesters who were also deeply anti-government, suspicious of the federal government, and holed themselves up and ended up with really disastrous, tragic ends. Jeff, bring us up to date on the latest in the Flint, Michigan water saga.
So a really sad story, and the latest in that saga is that attorneys who are filing a class action suit have subpoenaed emails from Governor Rick Snyder and other state agencies dating back to 2011 about the Flint water crisis. The state has until February 9th to respond or to file a motion to prevent the release of those emails. The governor has already released some emails from 2014 and 2015, but they were heavily redacted, and so critics are saying that's not enough. He also signed an executive order creating a committee to work on the long-term solutions to the water crisis. But he's under a lot of political fire right now, and so the question will be whether that's enough.
Yeah, I think this is really, frankly, an abject failure of government, right, to provide basic services to its citizens. Back in 2014, the city of Flint switched from Lake Huron water, which supplied Detroit, to Flint River water. Residents immediately began noticing that the water was brown. The local GM plant refused to use it, said that it corroded its car parts. And officials kept saying, oh, it's fine. There's nothing wrong. And then slowly this has come out that there was lead in the water, unsafe levels of lead. This is truly a horrifying
and children have been
situation.
Tested and with
children,
lead in their
and
system.
Children have been tested, and Michigan's governor said this week that we don't know how many more children are affected.
All right. Let's go to the calls now. I want to bring in Samuel in Fort Washington, Maryland. Samuel, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm an African-American, and me and my friends just been having fun with the Bondi situation where people just hold up guns against the federal government. And I was just thinking, If a couple of African-Americans had done this, I wonder how it would have turned out to be. And it seemed like they just were doing whatever they wanted to do. They threatened. They make a lot of threats with their guns. And I feel like nothing was done. And me being black, I'm thinking in my head, I wonder if we do something like that. What would any police department would have done to us?
Okay, that's a good question from Samuel. He wants to know about the Oregon, the protesters in Oregon who are holed up there, and had they been black and not sort of white governments, anti-government separatists, what would have happened to them?
I mean, that's a fantastic question and one that has been raised, and a lot of black activists, folks in the Black Lives Matter, have use that as an example and said, if those were black men or black teenagers with guns, this could have turned out very differently. And they point to things like Baltimore and Ferguson and the way that the police have acted, and they see a double standard. And that is part of and will play into that whole discussion that we're still having as a nation about the role of the police and the role of race in enforcing our laws, and the disparity between how different groups are treated. This is, the caller is exactly right. This is an example of the differences in how people are treated, and it will, I think, continue to be part of the political discussion.
Absolutely. I think Chris put it perfectly. This is a very, very relevant question in a time when we are all focused on very complicated issues of race and policing. Not only how would black people have been treated had they been holed up there with guns, but how would Muslims have been treated?
All right. Let's take another call from Anthony in York, Pennsylvania. Anthony, you're on the line.
Yes, I wanted to say a whole lot of things, but I'll just say it quickly. I don't like the way the press, and I'm a long-time listener with 25 years of Diane Rehm in several states I've lived in. I lived in D.C. over 20 years.
So great.
I don't know if it's going to leak. But I don't like the way the most of the press is handling Donald Trump with some of the foolish and irresponsible things he may say, not just about international, about national. I think you ought to question him more and help him to explain himself. But Brett, I think you ought to give it a pass, I'll say more than 90% of the time, with a few exceptions.
All right.
Also, Ronald Reagan was saying the same thing back in the late 70s. I'm in my 60s, and I remember that. And he used to say a lot of foolish things. Eventually, he came around and stopped saying some of them. And the press acted the same way, but this is a different generation of press people.
All right. Well, Anthony, thank you very much. So he has a criticism for us in the media. He says that, you know, Donald Trump is saying a lot of crazy things and getting away with them because the press is afraid to challenge him. Is that true?
I don't think the press is afraid to challenge it. And I think we have challenged him. And it seems as if, you know, all the fact checks that we do after these debates or about his policies, they don't seem to break through. It does not seem to move any needles. The people have not fallen off their support for Donald Trump because the fact checkers have pointed out that some of what he's saying can't be done or wouldn't be done or is impractical. However, I do agree with the caller that, you know, the way we do cover Trump does tend to be more as an entertainment and less as, any rally he has, we carry it as news. And I think, you know, the saturation coverage is something that the caller, you know, rightly points out, kind of fuels what we're seeing in the Trump rise.
And it's fair to note that Donald Trump has been very successful at manipulating his coverage. I mean, we saw that just this week with his choice not to go to the Republican debate, and he got a lot of attention for that from the media. There's legitimate criticism out there.
And a lot of cameras, though, turned out to cover him last night when he chose not to answer questions from the press. So the media does play a role as well.
All right. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. All right, well, let's take another call. This one is from Rich in Hudson, Ohio. Rich, go ahead.
Hi, folks. First of all, I enjoy the Friday panel. It's
the best
hour of my week.
Oh, that is so touching. Thank you.
Anyway, the panel made a comment about how the Democrats have lost a lot of congressional seats during Obama's tenure. But I would contend that much of that is because of Republican efforts to gerrymander over the last 20 years. So my question is, why haven't the Democrats pushed more for legislation that would require fairer redistricting processes?
All right. Thank you very much, Rich.
Well, I think Rich raises a good question, and part of that is they have, you know, raised that, and that has been an effort by Democrats across the country. But the fact of the matter is that they don't control the governorships. They don't control the state legislatures, and that and the Republicans do. And Rich is right. They have gerrymandered some of those districts to make sure that they are safe Republican districts and safe Democratic districts. And we've seen less and less swing districts. And there has been a move afoot to, you know, redistrict, you know, much of the country in a way that is more competitive. However, whatever party has control of the governorships and the legislature, they're going to use that power to try to make their members of Congress as safe as possible. And in this case, it's been the Republicans, and they've been very successful at it.
We also are seeing a proactive push by Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia to look ahead to the 2020 census to try to redistrict and reshape in a fairer way. But it's a long way off.
All right. We're getting emails from listeners who want to point out a fact that came out today, came out this week, which was that emails that were newly released from Michigan show that Michigan state government employees were getting clean water while they were denying that there was anything wrong with the Flint water.
Yeah, I haven't seen those emails myself, but I think that that will all be part of this case that we were talking about earlier in terms of a potential class action suit and trying to get emails from the governor and other state agencies.
And one of the emails that did come out that I think was pretty damning for Governor Schneider was his then chief of staff, who wrote back in July of 2015 to the health department warning of lead in the water in Flint. And it was, and of course, the governor didn't take any action until that started to happen in October. So there was a lag there that also needs to be explained. And so that is part of what we'll start to see as these emails come out.
Yeah, at least 6 months.
Who knew what when?
At least 6 months when state employees were being given bottled water and the public was being reassured that nothing was wrong.
What did they know and when did they know?
Mm-hmm. It? Exactly. All right. Well, in the moments we have left, I want to point out that yesterday marked the 30th anniversary of the Challenger explosion. There were a number of commemorations yesterday. Many of us who were alive 30 years ago remember it. I remember being a student and seeing it and the shock and horror of it. Jeff?
I do, too. I was in elementary school, and there was an elementary school teacher, Krista McAuliffe, who was on that shuttle. And so all of the school kids, not to mention the rest of the country, were really excited about that particular launch and just so devastated by its explosion. Certainly for me and for others in my generation and others, it was like a John F. Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, it was the first news event that I remember living through as a child. You remember where you were and what you saw and the fact that...
And the whole country was glued to the television.
We were all watching and there were televisions in almost every classroom because it was, hey, a teacher's going to space, isn't this? And I remember when it blew up thinking, wait, what just happened? And the adults and wondering what just and having to process that really was a tragic moment for
the name Krista McAuliffe will stick with me forever, as will a description I read in a newspaper of the explosion. Someone wrote, it's cruel beauty, the picture of the Challenger exploding in white plume across the sky was described as cruel beauty, and I've never forgotten those words.
What about the legacy for NASA and for science education?
I think that's a wonderful question, and part of what's been interesting about the Obama administration is that, you know, they have reshaped how NASA works. They scrapped the shuttle program and then have tried to make it more of a private public partnership and you know, expand the competition, which was an interesting thing for a Democratic president to do. And I think NASA is in a place right now where its role is really unclear, and they're trying to chart a new path into the 21st century. We're talking about Mars. We're talking about, some of these big goals. But there doesn't seem to be a national movement behind a Mars shot in the same way that there was for a moon shot.
But NASA had a good year this year with the New Horizons flyby of Pluto and sending back those pictures. I actually have a neighbor who was the chief engineer on that project, and I was at the Jet Propulsion or the JPL labs the night that those photographs came back, and it was quite something to see and sort of a reminder that we can reach beyond in the way President Kennedy envisioned so many years ago when he talked about space exploration.
I would also add that you'll probably hear a lot more about this from the candidates because Florida is a swing state.
That's right.
At the top of the agenda at some point this
year. One important thing is, of course, that scientists made something like 100 changes since then to the shuttle to make it safer and more reliable, and I'm struck by how the whole Challenger disaster and then the Challenger Center has helped foster STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, so that has been a big legacy of it. All right, thank you so much for joining us. Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, national correspondent at The New York Times, Chris Freitz, investigative correspondent with CNN. Thank you to all you listeners for spending this hour with us. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.